It's Thursday, May 28th, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Folk Runyon. And tonight, we have as our special guest, Frater Julian of the Benjamin Franklin Encampment, who is an expert in Pennsylvania folklore relating to witchcraft and magic. Now, we will be discussing his paper on the mysterious Roman family of the colonial Quaker community and Johannes Calpius, the wizard of Wissahickon, and his cave of Calpius, and his apocalyptic prophecy in the 1690s. And we'll also be talking about the Ephrata Rosicrucian cloister. And then we'll move on toward modern times with Dutch powwow, and then hexcraft, and the curious case of the Hexen Cat and its capture, the York County 1920s hex murder case. So if you want to catch up on your American occult and witchcraft heritage, then tune in for Weird Pennsylvania on the air. And let me say this, there is a book called Weird Pennsylvania, and I didn't realize that they had a Weird Pennsylvania book when I put that title on it. We don't have any connection with that book, and we're not promoting it, although it may be very good and all that, but we're not promoting that book. And anyway, let me find out if, do we have Frater Julian on the line yet?
Good evening, folks. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. And really glad to have you on. And like I said, when I came up with this title for the show, Weird Pennsylvania, I didn't realize that these weird book people have done one for almost every state now, including Pennsylvania. But you've given us quite an outline here of what you're going to talk about, and we'll get on to your outline here. The first section was Quaker cunning folk, and that was Robert Roman and his sons and all. And you started off with a brief background of your research into the topic and you worked as a fellow in your university's Department of History and Politics and the original source documents that were held at Swarthmore College and the historical artifacts at the Chester County Historical Society. You want to pick it up from there and tell us about all that?
Sure, Pug. Well, first of all, thanks for having me this evening. It is an honor and a privilege. As you stated, I did some research with the Drexel Department of History and Politics, Drexel University in Philadelphia. And I was originally going to be doing research into the European witch trials. As the professor that I was working with, his name was Dr. Jonathan Seitz. He's published in the area of Italian witchcraft. And once him and I networked together, we caught up about some more local matters, and that's kind of how my research started. So as I dug into the local stuff, Polk, one of the first things that really stood out to me in the literature was this case of Philip Roman. And I started to do a little digging into the trial, so to speak, this Quaker legal proceeding, and I realized that there was maybe something more to it than the old poison the well story that we're all too familiar with. These guys, it was 1695, and it was December 9th, 1695, and there's kind of a blurb in the Quaker meeting notes that talks about Philip Roman and his brother Robert Roman. They call them Friends Children, being the Society of Friends. It says that they were spoke to about those arts and sciences, that being an abstract reference to, the practice of the occult. And it says that they seem to disown what is mentioned except astrology. And it says that much was said to them, but it was not received. So this is kind of the first slap of the wrist of the Roman family, and they don't seem too receptive to it. So just a quick outline of the family tree. You have Philip Roman Sr., and then you have his two sons, Philip and Robert Roman. So these are the two younger gentlemen that are kind of getting called into the principal's office there in Chester County that are being told that they shouldn't be practicing astrology. Now, you actually see a little bit earlier in the meeting minutes that they talk about a curiosity pertaining to astrology, chiromancy, geomancy, and negromancy. That's actually the verbiage they use there. And eventually, you find that they're going through the house to search for, you know, evidence of some kind. So by the king's authority in Pennsylvania at this point, he was it was not a state yet. Obviously, it was a province. They're still under British rule, obviously. And they have the king's authority to go into the house and search, and they find three books. And this is where I realized that this was not quite a typical case of the old village wise woman. They find the fourth book of occult philosophy. They find one chapter in that deals with necromancy. That's obviously pseudo Henry Cornelius Agrippa, as the scholarship shows, probably. They find Reginald Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is a critique on the practice of magic that tries to demonstrate that it's a superstitious thing, but inadvertently it becomes sort of a grimoire in and of itself. It's a very thorough catalog of spirits. I would almost describe it as a proto-Goetia, which is particularly pertinent to our interest here in the Order. And they also find another book called The Theomagia, or The Temple of Wisdom by John Hyden. And that's kind of a Rosicrucian book, and that's particularly interesting given the early American political landscape there. So they wrote these guys in, and they basically, you know, rake them over for being associated with the practice of the occult. It eventually culminates into this legal trial where Robert Roman, and he seems to be our key figure here, he's accused of taking away the wife of a man named Henry Hastings. And that's where things get really, really interesting. So as I did the research, I started to realize that this was sort of a serious accusation. He's now being accused of not only, you know, practicing judicial astrology and you know, answering questions such as, you know, where is the village horse that's been stolen. He's now being accused of breaking up a marriage. It's something quite more practical. We don't know if he's being accused here of you know, being a philanderer, or if he's being accused of maybe using some of his magical knowledge to interrupt you know, conjugal relations between a husband and wife. But we do know that it was serious enough to drag him into basically court. There were two separate courts at the time in the area. There was the Quaker court, so to speak, and there was also the King's court. And he was ready to get in trouble in both of them.
Interesting. Let me just catch up on something on Reginald Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft. You're absolutely right when you say that this book was published really to kind of discredit witchcraft. That was Scott's intention. But he had so much witchcraft and magic in there that it became a very popular book, and almost like a grimoire that people were buying. You know, it became a bestseller, and the king finally tried to have all the copies burned. And there's a similar thing with D.M. Kelly's, with Casaubon's True Relation for D.M. Kelly. He published that to discredit D.M. Kelly, and then that became the same thing. That got the whole Enochian system started. So they had a book that with the Discovery of Witchcraft, and of course Cornelius Agrippa. I can see where they would get in trouble with having both of those.
Sure. Absolutely. And the book that they found that was pseudo Agrippa poke, it was a chapter from the fourth book. That's what it seems like, and it actually deals explicitly with how to raise the dead. And it's not something, not in the showroom spook spiritualist sense, but it actually talks about getting down there basically with the blood, and I think it talks about mixing in eggs and things like that. So it's very explicit. And the other thing that's very interesting about the method that pseudo Agrippa talks about in the fourth book, he explicitly says when talking about this form of literal necromancy that you're only going to really have any success in raising the dead if it was somebody that you know, was a bad person, obviously hasn't had that smooth crossing over, or somebody that died tragically. So what you get in that sense, I think Blavatsky called them showroom spooks. You have the unsettled ghosts for one of a better term, that you're actually able to talk to. I think the worldview there is that anybody else is, you know, quite happily in the hereafter. So you're
yeah.
actually dealing with the remnants there when you're working that kind of practice. So you've got this whole, you know, saga unfolding with the Roman brothers, and basically, Pope, what happens is the one brother, Philip Jr., he's pretty quick to tuck his tail between his legs and kind of run in the other direction. And it's Robert who's younger. He was actually 23 at the time when this was all going down. He kind of dug his heels in, and he basically was accosted by the Quakers, and he said he was going to keep doing this as long as it would help others. And obviously that catches my eye because of some of the verbiage in the Fama Fraternitas in the Rosicrucians, who, you know, had this obligation to heal the sick gratis and all of these things. And I can't speculate that Roman was affiliated with them, but it is a poignant consideration given the library. So it is certainly an interesting thing. And the other thing is this environment to practice astrology. It was suggested to me by one of my referees in the academic review process that astrology was merely a form of hubris. And it was kind of a presupposition that the practitioner could make predictions, and, you know, how silly that is. And it's kind of a form of, you know, stroking one's own ego. But actually, these guys were involved in practical magic from their library, at the very least. And the Quakers in particular were very, very hostile to the Roman calendar. So they would not even use the Roman months. They started their year in March. It was actually, I think, March 25th or March 23rd. I think it was March 25th was their New Year's. And their dating structure throughout all of the paperwork in that time period is actually such that it says the first day of the first week of the first month. They won't say January because of the Roman connotations there and the god Janus. You know, all of these things are so pagan to them that they will not even use the name of the month. And here you have two young men, 20-something-year-old guys, that are literally in possession of books talking about how to raise the dead. You know, Reginald Scott's discovery of witchcraft goes into such particulars that it talks about, you know, you might have an easier time summoning the spirits in bad weather because they're, you know, inclined towards that. So, you know, it's bad enough if you can't use the Roman months. But to be caught with these books is you know, rather red-handed, if you might say so.
Well, they didn't get caught with any equipment though, except the sundial later on, and the sundial probably has some relation to astrology. You want to talk about that sundial though?
Yeah, absolutely. So years later, let me pull up the note here. A sundial was made, and it was actually tagged Philip Roman, which is kind of interesting because Philip Roman we thought was the one who kind of tucked his tail between his legs and was the so-called, you know, well-behaved one, for want of a better term. And it was actually, it was made in 1726. So all of this stuff started happening in 1695. In 1726, there's a brass sundial that was made that was tagged Philip Roman. Now, it could have been the father. It could have been Philip Sr., but it's probably more likely that it was Philip Jr., and this guy, he was something of a globetrotter. He was back and forth to England. He was described as a doctor of physic. So you see here this idea that you know, almost somewhat along the lines of Franz Barden, he was practicing medicine, obviously, in addition to whatever studies he would have been inclined towards. And he's got this sundial that it's this magnificent piece. It's about 6 or 7 inches in diameter, and it's held locally here in Westchester, Pennsylvania, which is only about 30 minutes from Philadelphia. And it's very intricate. It's so intricate, in fact, that one of the folks who read the initial draft of my paper thought that there was no way it could have actually been crafted by somebody here in the early colonies. And I think part of the interesting story there is that by marriage, the Roman family was actually related to the Taylor family. And that's where you get the connection to the almanac trade. There was a guy named Isaac Taylor. He was married to Philip's daughter, so it was basically the brother-in-law of Philip and Robert Roman. And Isaac Taylor was very prominent in his own right, and his brother Jacob was an almanacier, very much like Ben Franklin, our encampment's namesake. And he would dabble in you know, esoteric trimmings in his almanacs. And to find out that the gentleman being accused here of astrology and divination and even necromancy have that kind of a connection to somebody in the literary field who was actually known to trade in books, and not only that, but also produce occult literature. Jacob Taylor actually had produced one of the first, I think, the first catalogs of solar and lunar eclipses on American soil. So he was obviously, you know, very well versed in astrology in his own right. So to see that kind of connection here shows that it quite literally is a family affair here for these guys.
I think where the sundial is, if you start digging around with your trowel under the hearth or something, I'll bet you're going to dig up an astrolabe, and if you keep digging, you might dig up a little chest with some Solomonic tools in it, and that would be very exciting. Yeah, because I suspect, you know, I from reading this on a Richard Paper course and from reading about the Roman family, I suspect that some tools are hidden around somewhere, and they just didn't find them when they searched the house. Do you want to tell us about this Johannes Kelpius, the wizard of Wissahickon?
Sure, absolutely. You don't get too far in researching the local occult history of Polk without stumbling upon the work of Johannes Kelpius. Colloquially, we call him the Wizard of the Wissahickon. So, actually, ironically enough, I think it was 1694. Let me just double check that. It's 1694. He comes over here to America, and it was actually June 23rd, 1694, to maybe better localize this. So a couple days after the summer solstice, Johannes Kelpius comes to American soil, and he's right in northwest Philadelphia in the Fairmount Park section. Runs right along the creek there, and him and his followers, they're described in the more reserved literature as German pietists. They themselves kind of form the Society of the Woman in the Wilderness. And there's been all sorts of speculation as to what exactly they were involved in. I know Kelpius himself had his hands in a lot of pots, but there has been speculation that there's been ties to early Rosicrucianism here. And it's one thing to say that there's a gentleman in the caves in the 1690s, but Johannes Kelpius had letters going in every which direction. He had people that he was in touch with here. And there's always been a sort of a mystical mystique around him. Part of that owes to his prophecy that the world was ending very soon. So he was only, I believe, you know, 20-something years old, maybe 28 years old when he came over here, in his mid to late 20s. And he was already prophesizing that the end days were here. So that's kind of how he settled himself in as the head figure of the Society of the Woman in the Wilderness. So they, you know, this is. You know, you talked a little bit about John Dee, and you know, this is headed right into that Christian idea of, you know, apocalypse, and they're basically bunkering down in the caves there with the Society of the Woman in the Wilderness.
It also sounds like a very early millenarian cult before Miller. You know, it sounds like this guy had the first millenarian cult. You know, that in anthropological terms, we talk about apocalyptic cults, are referred to as millenarian, and after a guy named Miller who started one, about, I guess, 100 years after Kelpius. Yeah, so what about his cave?
So there is actually, you can actually still find it. Unfortunately, it's been collapsed. I think by some Parks and Rec folks eventually collapsed the cave. But it's in Fairmount Park. There's a little section of the park that actually has trails and whatnot. And he had a cave there, and you can actually still find it. There's also a hermitage that they call it. There's a cave, and there's also some kind of, you know, underground building of some sorts. I think there, at some point there were people that speculated that they found his prayer hut or his house. And whether or not Johannes Kelpius was a Rosicrucian, that is perhaps a question for another day. But I will tell you this, at some point in much more recent history, I want to say it was the 70s or the 80s, The AMORC whisked over to Pennsylvania, and I know that the AMORC, I think, originally was a West Coast thing, but they're everywhere now. They put up a rather big monument to their brother, Johannes Kelpius. So whether or not he was a Rosicrucian, the Rosicrucians have adopted him. And they,
well, Spencer Lewis liked to say that Akhenaten was the first Rosicrucian. That was his, that was one of his ideas. And of course, he also started the Lemurians on Mount Shasta, and then he backed out of that one when there got to be too many of them up there. if Johannes Kelpius was connected with the Rosicrucians, that leads us to this Ephorata cloister of the Rosicrucians in colonial times in Pennsylvania.
And yes.
You think he might have been connected with them?
You know, I don't know that he was connected with them. I think they were a little later. I think they were in the early 1730s, there was this Ephorata cloister. And your expertise there, Pope, probably is far excessive of my own. I know that we have a connection there through the Johannes Gutel.
Not mine. Let me say this. One of our very, very good brothers, Brother Hermes, managed to get into some of what has survived of their archives, and he found a representation of Johann Gichtel's Natural Man, which is the original Western psychic center system, the original Western chakra system. And they had a reproduction of this in their, rather crude, in their records or in their documents. So we can speculate that they were perhaps acquainted with the Western yoga system, but that's just a speculation. However, I do recall seeing one of their buildings, the big wooden dormitory photograph of it. I think it's still standing with tiny little windows. It didn't look like something you really wanted to stay inside. and I don't know if that's still in existence, but I remember seeing a photograph of it. They did have quite a little community going for a while. Now you say Amwork has an official presence in the Philadelphia area now?
Honestly, I don't claim any affiliation there. I do know that Amwork has a Pranowitz in Allentown, which is a little bit further, out of the city area. But they did rush to put that monument at the Kelpius site, which is kind of an interesting thing. I think that was 30, 40 years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. But now Amwork is rather ubiquitous in this country. They claimed Kelpius. And, the Ephorata Cloister, I'm looking at the date now, it was 1732. So maybe 36 years after Kelpius was settled in. And then obviously, I guess it was good for the Ephorata Cloister that the world did not end, because that was what Kelpius was banking on. As you mentioned, there's a lot of speculation. These guys, it seems like they were involved in some rather hermetic studies, maybe even some Rosicrucian studies. There's very little definitive there. You can only kind of, see the smoke to the fire of the rose, so to speak. Even in the Roman case, they had the book Theomagia by John Haydn, which is rather Rosicrucian in its scope. And at some point, Haydn says, we're not of the Rosy Cross, but we're interested in their studies or their mysteries or something along those lines. And in the book, Theomagia, it's actually got a preface by Georgius Stark. And there's speculation among the academic crowd, but I think there's a pretty good case that Georgius Stark was actually Irenaeus Philalethes, who was probably the preeminent American alchemist. So whether or not these guys were in the upper echelon of you know, the Hermetic elite in the country, they were certainly reading their books. And to me, that says something right there, because we're not talking about, you know, being able to run to the bookstore. We're talking about colonial times, and even to have a book or a library, I think, is a rather poignant thing at that point in history.
Yeah, and having to order books and to have them sent over from England by ship. Oh boy, you know, I mean, and you were lucky if you could get them on the ship, and then if you were lucky if they got on the ship, they'd never get to you. But I can see it would be really, really difficult. And Kelpius, has any of Kelpius's work survived? His writings.
I believe so. There are some letters that I've seen floating about, and there's also a number of books I've seen some across in the Weiser catalog. Basically, he appears in a lot of anthologies on German Pietism and things of that nature. So not only Kelpius, the other big keyword there is his society. I mean, he was kind of the figurehead, as you said, the Miller of a potential doomsday cult. But, you know, that lends itself to a whole cast of personalities in and of itself. Any order or cult is going to have, you know, the number two and the Don Quixote and the Pancho Villas and, you know, all of these guys. This crazy horse has his people. so he certainly had his followers, and their work is out there as well. So it's definitely an interesting cast of people. One of the things that Kelpius supposedly had, and this might lend to your idea that he was a figurehead or a cult of personality, he had this thing that they called a stone of wisdom. And that was supposedly half of a stone that he had come across in India. And that thing has sort of taken on a rather legendary relic status almost. So you have this guy in colonial America that came over from Germany that has this Indian artifact. And that is, you know, that is just a very curious thing to anybody, you know, 300 or 400 years ago to have your hands on a real piece of the Orient. So he really had a lot of interesting legends pop up around him. There's actually a legend that stone was thrown into the Wissahickon River, or Wissahickon Creek, excuse me. So, yeah. You know, there's, you know, he's got his very own Holy Grail, you know, legend, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, moving right along, let's look at your outline here. Let's talk about the Dutch powwow system or tradition or whatever. I know powwow sounds kind of like an Indian powwow. Does that work?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that the scholarship there, you're absolutely right. At some point when these practices, this sort of a folk magic practiced by the Dutch, the folks that were not quite in the know, for lack of a better term, they thought it looked rather native or Native American, so they used the term powwow. You know, it's kind of akin to the Redskins. You know, it's a very colloquial term to refer to something that looks vaguely shamanistic to them. So they used this term powwow to describe really what didn't have anything to do with Native American shamanism whatsoever. As you're well aware, folks, this kind of stuff, this Pennsylvania Dutch folk magic, it comes from German grimoires. And most of them were actually rather Christian in nature. They weren't shamanistic at all. They were, you know, much more closer to the Solomonic or the Albertus Magnus material than they had anything to do with, you know, Cherokee or anything like that, or Lenape or any number of tribes.
Yeah, well, we mentioned the sixth and seventh books of Moses were quite prominent among these folks.
Absolutely.
This gets us into the end of the whole hex sign business, and everybody, I think everyone, even people who haven't been to Pennsylvania, and when I was a kid, I spent some time in Pennsylvania, and I remember driving through the countryside, and my mother, who was, you know, Pennsylvania Dutch, and she would point to the hex sign. Every time you'd see a hex sign in a barn, she'd say, look at the hex sign, you know. So I think I've seen a bunch of hex signs between somewhere on the way past Scranton to Lake Ariel. I saw a lot of hex signs. Are they still, do you still find them on the barns around there?
Oh, Poke, absolutely. Not only do you have hex signs, there's kind of a new cottage industry of folks that still craft them along traditional lines. So yeah, as you said, once you get up in the more rural areas of the state, whether you're talking about Berks County or Yorks County or Northampton County, you know, there's any number of barns and you know, even slaughterhouses and things like that, you will see these hex signs that are painted on the barn. And you know, it's kind of an unspoken of, you know, matter of fact. The local folks don't really bat an eye at them, and they tend to pop up in areas that are quite Christian. You know, these Amish or the Mennonite areas are a lot of the farmers here in Pennsylvania, and of course, you know, throughout the East Coast in Ohio and Delaware and places like this. And these hex signs, you know, they're almost like a calling card. And the name obviously calls forth the idea of witchcraft and hexery. And also, hex is six, and you've got the idea of the sixth and seventh books of Moses. And that attribution was not lost on folks. So one of the biggest books, in addition to the sixth and seventh books of Moses, that was practiced by these powwow, and quite honestly, Poke, it's still practiced today, but we'll get into that in a little bit. There was called the long-lost friend, or the Long Whispered Friend. It was written by George Hallman. And, you know, there's people out there that still work this book. It's kind of a mixture between a prayer book and a grimoire. And it's very practical in terms of, you know, you can only imagine how things kind of were out here on the early American frontier. You know, if you're bleeding or if you have a toothache, you know, here's how you stop a toothache. So very, very practical and almost rustic in some of the usage of it there. And these hex signs, you know, they are rather ubiquitous, and some of these barns out here are quite old. And you even see barns that have, you know, been built much more recently that obviously have, you know, a very tenderly crafted hex sign placed on there still to this day, because for these folks that farm, this is their livelihood. And whether or not it's a religious thing for them or not, they're not going to take any chances. They're not going to risk not putting up the hex sign and having their crop, you know, gone or anything like that. There's actually a book by Nigel Pennick that goes into some of the geometry and stuff like that behind the hex signs. In terms of the powwow, there's a great book that was published, I think, in 2009 called The Red Church by an actual modern-day practitioner of hexcraft, or what they call braquery. And yeah, it's still very prevalent. There are practitioners, you know, it's kind of a word of mouth thing. If you were to drive up to the, you know, the Berks County or the Reading, Pennsylvania area, and let's say you had a really bad illness and you floated some word of mouth stuff to people that were in the know, they might whisper you down a few hallways and around a few dark corners, and you're going to find a real legitimate practitioner of Pennsylvania powwow. And that is still very much, you know, almost like it is in the African diaspora and the hoodoo practitioners. This something more Christian, but still very much a real thing, and people that need help will go seek out these, you know, these Hexenmeisters, as they're called.
Ah, sort of like Santeria in the Afro-Caribbean community. Yeah. You've got something here in the outline about the curious case of the elusive Hexen cat. And it was captured. So this sounds like a chupacabra. So tell us about that.
There's a smattering of newspaper articles in the early 1900s. It was actually 1911, Pope, and a number of newspaper articles in the Philadelphia Public Ledger, and one I think even made its way to the Washington Herald. It was Pottsville, Pennsylvania, and there was a case where a woman, her name was Mary Isabella Thomas. Her father passed away under, I guess, mysterious circumstances, and the family farm had this, you know, awful rash of bad luck. And for one reason or another, the charge of witchcraft was raised by the bereaved. And somehow this turned into a rather big story that was in the newspapers at the time. And this was not, you know, in the equivalent of the Sun or the Weekly World News. This was right there in the Washington Herald. It was in the Philadelphia Public Ledger with the news of the day. And there are some very, very interesting headlines. I'll read you one. September 24th, 1911, the Philadelphia Public Ledger had a headline. and it read, "Blamed the witch cat. Girl declared hex had caused father's death." That was followed up 6 days later in the same newspaper on September 30th, and it said, "Hexahammeron cat will break spell." So one of the things that actually happened was they were sure that the curse was caused by a cat, and they were trying to kill this cat with a gold bullet. So the newspaper reads, "Ever since preparations were made to shoot the hex cat with a gold bullet, it has failed to put in an appearance at the Thomas farm, and the hex doctors decided that the evil spell cast over the Thomas homestead can only be dispelled by installing a certain black cat." So there was a cat that was owned by a guy in Schuylkill County that was born on the sixth day of the sixth month in 1906. So June 6th, 1906, there was a black cat born, supposedly in a litter of six kittens. And the newspaper goes so far as to say that it was blind for only 6 days after being born, and all normal cats are only blind for 9 days. So the Hexen doctors apparently got together in some kind of a grand council and decided that since they could not kill the cat, they were going to park a special black cat on the family property, which was going to act as some kind of talisman against harm. Now, that's not where the story ends. The Washington Herald, on October 2nd, a week or so later, declares that the demon cat is captured. And it says that it was captured by a Bible thrown at it. This kind of conjures up an image of some poor cat having a huge piece of literature thrown at it. captured by a Bible thrown at it, the only witch cat the hex believers of Schuylkill County know to be in captivity is tonight being exhibited in a show window here behind 8-inch steel bars, where hex doctors are anxiously studying the creature to determine whether it is the animal which Miss Mary Thomas blames for the death of her father and a long train of other misfortunes in the Thomas family. So at some point, they found a black cat that seemed to be guilty. They threw it behind bars, and they studied it with some kind of a scientific fervor.
But they never shot it with a gold bullet, did they?
I don't think they ever got to it with a gold bullet, but they did try to park that special, they call it a hexahammeron cat. You know, and it begs the question of, you know, who these hex doctors were that came up with this idea. You know, this was the think tank of Pottsville, Pennsylvania, getting together, and they all mulled it over, and they said, you know, there is this special cat that was born under mysterious circumstances, this 66666 cat, and we're going to park it at the house. And a week or so later, they put the other cat behind bars. And, you know, it occurred to me, Polk, that this is all coinciding. You know, at this point, it's October 2nd, and it's getting quite close to Halloween here. And, you know, you've got this story running in the newspapers about the hex cat, you know?
Yeah.
But it was a rather fantastical story. And, I mean, this thing literally pops up in, you know, four to six newspaper articles in the span of a week or two. I mean, this was big news back in the day.
Well, you remember when Orson Welles did his Mars invasion, October 31st. Boo. Yeah. So that's if you're gonna do something like that, Halloween's a good time to be doing it. And you know, keeping going on on this theme, you have here a note about the York County 1920s murder case. Which was written about in a book called Hex by Arthur Lewis, later I guess it did as a film called Apprentice to Murder. Was that with Sutherland, starring Sutherland?
Yes, sir. That's actually based on that story that was originally written about in Hex by Arthur Lewis.
And were you gonna tell us about that murder case?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a case in the 1920s, and this goes to show, you know, the ubiquity of this so-called powwow or Hexenmeister subculture that existed at the time. You know, it's easy for us to say that there were a few guys that were practicing Hexenry, but there was actually a rather vast network. In Arthur Lewis's book, and I don't pretend to know the level of scholarship behind it, but he really alludes to this, you know, incredible network of Hexenmeisters in the area. You know, I think he numbers it either hundreds or thousands of them. So there is this underground culture of what they would call hex doctors. And at one point in the 1920s, one of these guys was, you know, as the story goes, you know, there's nothing new under the sun, and you see it in Robert Roman, and you see it with the hex cat. One of the practitioners in the area was accused of, you know, doing something at someone else's expense. I think there was maybe the charge that there was a curse put on someone. And a few of the guys got together and they killed him. And that was the murder trial. So it was actually the Hexenmeister, the hex doctor, was suspected of some kind of you know, magical mischief, and they killed him. And that was the murder trial. So it was a rather sensationalistic murder case. But you know, this is a very interesting subculture we have out here, Pope. There is a certain element out here, just like you have out there out west with the, you know, the Mount Shasta stuff. There is this kind of sense of timelessness. So in a community like that, there is still that rustic, you know, old world flair. There was a story a year or so back where an Amish, a rather extreme Amish sect, got together and they went after another man's beard and they cut off the beard. And there was a question as to whether or not that was going to be prosecuted in present day as a hate crime, because that's a very serious thing to cut off a beard.
Yeah.
So the Amish and the folks out there, the Mennonites and the Amish and that kind of Christian sect, even to this very day, I mean, we're talking about the 1920s, but even now in 2015, still a very seriously religious people, and any kind of religious slight is taken very, very seriously. So, yeah, they got together in the 1920s, a few of these guys that thought to have been bereaved by this hex doctor, and they killed them. And Arthur Lewis's book talks about that case, but he also talks a little bit about, you know, just what kind of culture was behind that. The book is called Hex.
Yeah.
It was published by Arthur Lewis, a public book printed by Arthur Lewis.
Let me ask you this now, because I'm kind of aware, and I think most of us who are following the magical tradition, we're aware that that there was a after following the Renaissance and into the so-called era of Enlightenment, magic following the Renaissance took several turns. One turn was it went more Kabbalistic with the infusion of the Kabbalah, and that affected the Rosicrucians too. But in Germany, and I'm asking you this to find out whether or not you think this may have come over. In Germany, something was developed called the Faustian School of Magic. And
Sure. And
there's a whole bunch of books, a whole bunch of grimoires that came out around that time. And, of course, we had the printing press, and so they produced a lot of these grimoires that were printed. It were of the Faustian variety, and the Faust, of course, as we all know, he was a scholar who sold his soul to the devil and whatever. But these Faustian books were pretty dark, and even you might even say they were bordering on being satanic. Now, do you think that Faustian school got over into our so-called Pennsylvania Dutch area?
You know, that's a good question. To be honest with you, folks, I think that the method of practice probably took a kind of a split approach between the Rosicrucian Hermetic bend and also the Christian Kabbalistic bend of the sixth and seventh Moses and the Albertus Magnus school, which I'm sure you're familiar. But I will say this, and it's particularly interesting. I know recently republished in German was Faust's Threefold Coercion of Hell. That was just republished, I believe. And one of the trademarks.
You mean the Threefold Harrowing of Hell?
I'm looking. I see that there's been a published in Germany It's called The Threefold Coercion of Hell, first published in 1505, and then...
Yeah, over here it's called The Harrowing of Hell, but I guess that's just the way it was translated.
Okay, yeah. The main motif of the book is The Harrowing of Hell, I see here. So, one of the trademark motifs in that book in terms of the literary publication of it, as I'm sure you're familiar if you've looked at any of the manuscripts, is that it was published in this red and black ink. And it was kind of a, you know, as you're reading about Mephistopheles and how to summon all these demons, you know, along the lines of Faust or Dr. Faustus, you actually see that the publication in Germany was red and black. And, you know, being a German product, I don't know if it was the way the printing presses were set up, but you also see the same kind of printing in some of the sixth and seventh books of Moses. I was on Joe Peterson's site before the show tonight, kind of skimming through the sixth and seventh books of Moses, and you see the circles and things are all in red and black. So it is, it's an interesting, you know, you might just say that the Germans, that's the way that they do things. I know in the occult tradition, red and black and white have all sorts of different, you know, connotations, and it's almost Solomonic, the red and the white stuff. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly that, you know, this is German stuff. You know, you're dealing with the Pennsylvania Dutch, and there's the German influence there as well. Whether or not the Faustian stuff, you know, dovetails with the sixth and seventh books of Moses, I think that's an interesting question for scholars. You know, I think that there might be some ground to be tread there with comparing the, you know, the German magical texts from both the Christian and the so-called diabolical traditions to see, you know, just what they do have in common versus how different they are.
Well, you were talking about the 1920s murder case that was written about in the book Hex by Arthur Lewis, and you ended up as apprentice to murder in the films, and that's why I brought up the subject of the Faustian books, because I thought maybe if we do have that sort of thing going on, then the dark side of it would certainly, in a transplanted German community, because when we say Pennsylvania Dutch, that's what we mean. And we're talking about people from Germany, basically. And it, that's correct, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, you've got, you know, obviously the Dutch proper and the Germans and this kind of a melting pot. You know, I will say this, too. You're absolutely right. It only presupposes that if you've got this community of people that heal the sick, and they're the folks you go to when you lose something or you need to be cured of an ailment, it only makes sense that there might be a more malefic type of trade to be utilized. And I think that in the case of Hex by Arthur Lewis, the practitioner was accused of throwing a curse and then he was later murdered. So what kind of books would he have used for something like that? That's a real good question. You know, there
yeah,
is
I don't
this,
think
there's,
I, yeah, we're getting... We're getting down, you know, toward the end of the hour here, and I think we ought to get off this dark stuff, you know, and because that I really don't think you want to emphasize that talking about your occult tradition. We don't want to emphasize
right.
The dark end. I thought I'd mention it in connection with the. The murder case and the Hexen Cat and whatever. What about this Hexenkopf Rock in Northampton County?
Sure.
What's the story on that?
You know, this dovetails rather nicely with your question about the Native Americans and things like that. And, you know, just to backpedal a little bit, if there's one thing that's clear from all of this, you know, whether it's beneficial magic or evil magic, for lack of a better term, the one thing is very clear. From colonial times up through present day, there is definitely a widespread belief in magic in general out here. And I don't think that's a uniquely Pennsylvania thing, but that's something that's certainly poignant. I mean, there is a definite pedigree here of a rather spiritual people. But to go to your particular question about Hexenkopf Rock, there is a rock up there in Northampton County that has a rather legend of its own. And I actually think, to dovetail this back to your topic, I think this does appear in the Weird Pennsylvania book. This rock has a reputation of being a mysterious place, and the legend goes that it was actually used by the Hexenmeisters or the Powwowers as this place of power. So, you know, you see throughout America and even the occult tradition these various places of power. you know, they seem to invariably be underground or caves, you know, like Glastonbury Tours, the iconic underground fairy mound. And you've got Mount Shasta and Shambhala, you know, the gateway to Shambhala out there in California. And here in Pennsylvania, we have Hexenkopf Rock. And that translates loosely to the Witch's Head. And that is in Northampton County. And the legend goes that that's a place where, you know, the Hexenmeisters or the Powwowers get together and you know, work ritual. Before that, there is an idea that it was maybe used by Native Americans. And that is, you know, where they sort of liberally acquired the place of power from was the Native Americans before then. And that's part of the allure of it, that it was used for Native American rites, supposedly. I mean, that's not a particularly scholarly assertion, but I think that's why people go there. That's what they believe.
Yeah, so did anybody put any hex, any petroglyph or pictograph hex signs or anything on it?
I don't know for sure. I think it's one of those places, you know, that kind of has the, you know, the locals that go up to it and they hang out and they want to see what it's all about. And as I understand it, it's now on private property. So I've not been there myself, but I know that there's pictures on the internet of it. And they call it the Witch's Head because it resembles something of a face. And also the legend behind it, that it was this mysterious place. You know, and that can go one of either two ways. It's either a place to be avoided or it's going to track everyone. You know, the thrill seekers and the serious practitioners that are looking for a place of power. I mean, there's always, invariably, there's a legend about a place of power. I mean, one that comes to mind is, you know, Bill Gray had the Rollright Stones in England. There's always this monolithic structure. There's always this local Stonehenge that's going to be, you know, attended to by the local practitioners.
Yeah, well, one time Fred Adams took off for Europe and left us here to find the exact center of spiritual center of Los Angeles. And so we all went trooping out to exactly where he had laid this thing out on the two ley lines where they crossed. And we got in the middle of the Baldwin Hills area. And it was absolutely desolate. And down in this bottom was this cistern. And it was like, like a desert. It's this dry cistern. And right in the middle, right where the two lines crossed, if you want to survey this thing, was a dead scorpion. And that was the center. So that unfortunately turned out to be our... We had to report to the master when he returned that, yes, we had gone there, but it was not what we what we all expected. So I hope that your Hexenkopf Rock is you know, I'd like to see it. I remember when I was growing up there in Lake Ariel, we had a little island in the one end of the lake. It was a little bitty island and had some rocks and it got a few trees on it. And they called it Dumb Man's Island. And I, you know, curious little kid, and I said, why is it Dumb Man's Island? Well, way back in the old days, there was a dumb hermit that lived in a small cabin on this tiny little island in the middle of the lake. That's what they told me, anyway. Yeah, so there there are lots of mysterious things that we've been talking about. And next time we get out to Pennsylvania, we can make a pilgrimage to the Rock or something like that.
Absolutely.
And this really has been fascinating. And, you know, it's especially fascinating to me, having spent some time as a child in your area, and you know, like I say, driving through the country and having my mother point to every hex sign on every barn as we went by, so I really kind of feel like I've got the Pennsylvania Dutch in my blood and in my heritage, and I really, really appreciate this. You know, your paper, I read your paper which for the Historical Society on the Roman family and found it fascinating. Are you going to do a summary kind of a thing on all of the things we talked about tonight?
I'd like to. You know, there's a lot of stuff in the local history area that touches the surface, but there is so much more. And I would hope to. So that paper that you read, Pope, that was published in 2013 in a journal called Pennsylvania History. That's put out by Penn State University Press, and it is available on the Internet Archive, known as JSTOR. And most colleges can get into that paper for free. So if you do a search for my paper, it's called The Quaker Cunning Folk. So your listeners might find it there. And if they have an affiliation or they're students in a college, they probably can download it for free. Otherwise, it's a nominal fee, but that goes right to my publisher. It doesn't go to me. Poke, I mean, there is so much fertile ground for research in what we do. I mean, it was Frances Yates that said, you know, she was just scratching the tip of the iceberg some 60 years ago. And I think that's absolutely true to this day. Academia is only beginning to really dig into the esoteric side of things. And, you know, as you know, as an anthropologist, you know, there is so much there in terms of just an anthropological research point of view, too, and what people believe in general. Yeah, absolutely. I hope to do more.
Yeah, like I say, I'd like to get up there around the old Roman homestead with my trowel and see if I can dig up those tools that I suspect are buried somewhere around there. And Father Julian, this has been fascinating and really, really exciting, and thank you so much for sharing all this with us, and thank you also for the other thing which I better not mention, because we're liable to be visited by the Quaker police if I do.
it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, right. and thanks so much. And next week we're going to try to have another guest. I can't say that he's going to be, he or she will be as fascinating as Father Julian, but we're going to try to have another one. And Father Julian, take care, be well, and good magic.
Thank you, folks. Sora Talasa sends her regards as well. Have a good night, sir. Thank you so much.